Good morning and welcome to Cool Science Radio. It's science that's accessible and entertaining. I'm Lynn Ware-Peek here with my co-host John Wells. Today in the program, we speak first with Dr. Eric Sierstad of the Space Dynamics Lab at Utah State University. Now, we all have secret dreams about being an inventor, having patents with our name attached, and even to solve the mysteries of the cosmos. Well, our first guest is doing it, and we'll speak to him about this national news just out from Utah State University.
Good morning, Lynn.
Good morning, John.
Beautiful day out there. Another scientist from one of Utah's esteemed institutions is Dr. David Belknap from the University of Utah, and he specializes in imaging viruses. He deconstructs them, studies them, and finds out what makes viruses tick, and he'll join us in the second half of the hour.
All that plus today's cool story. It's about the mystery, which has now been solved, behind how 500-pound boulders were randomly moved in Death Valley. It's been in the news over the last day, and I like this story. Not an alien encounter, even high winds, but find out toward the end of the hour. Stay with us. It's Cool Science Radio, only in Park City, only on KPCW.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
This is Steve Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties, formerly Prudential Utah. We continue to be proud supporters of KPCW and are excited to embark on the next era of Park City real estate under our new brand. More info at bhhsutah.com.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware-Peek here with John Wells. Well, our first guest, Dr. Eric Sierstad, has to be pretty excited right about now. After all, he now has a patent attached to his name, a patent for an invention that he's created at the Space Dynamics Lab at Utah State University. Now, this thing you'll remember, it has a handy acronym. It's called IDEA. It stands for Imaging Dispersive Energy Analyzer IDEA. So what this thing does in simple terms, which I'm sure Dr. Sierstad will be able to complicate and then unravel for us, it can take an orbiting satellite, in relative terms, orbiting quite near Earth's surface, and to gather the gases and the plasma particles surrounding the satellite to then decipher and determine what the makeup is in that area of space. Now, what this will do, I believe, is to help us understand with more depth the impact of space weather, you know, wind, temperature, density, and composition. So why is this important, you may ask? Well, our guest, Dr. Eric Sierstad, is joining us to tell us why. Good morning and welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Good morning and thanks for having me on.
Well, it's nice to have you, and congratulations on this patent that you've received. I assume this is big news in your world.
It is very big news, yeah. It's been an exciting, very exciting week.
Yeah, great. So why don't we start kind of with the basics for those of us, John, myself, and our listeners who may be lay people. Let's talk about where these orbits are, I mean, where these satellites are orbiting that your invention will be, I don't know, I'm assuming attached to in some way. Are we talking about the Earth's atmosphere? Are we talking about a little further out in space? Where are they?
This is just a bit further out. So this would be in a region of space known as the thermosphere and ionosphere. And the typical altitude of these orbits would be somewhere from 300 up to maybe 500 or 600 kilometers above the surface of the Earth. And basically, the thermosphere and ionosphere is the kind of the lower region of space where the upper part of Earth's atmosphere is generally considered to fade out and transition into space somewhere around 85 or 90 kilometers. And then there's this region that extends up through about 500 or 600 kilometers into the what's known as the exosphere, which goes a bit higher, maybe to about 1,000 kilometers. And that's where we have this finally transition into the vacuum of space. And this entire region, basically, where the upper atmosphere is very highly influenced by, mainly by the sun, energy coming in from the sun. And so that's what we're interested in measuring is the impact of that energy and how that energy ends up distributing into the atmosphere and coupling between these two regions of space, the thermosphere and ionosphere.
Why is this area then particularly influenced by the sun more than other areas of space?
Well, a big part of it is, you know, you have the solar wind, which is basically, it's kind of the faucet which is on all the time, coming, blasting from the sun at a high rate of speed. And so solar wind particles basically arrive from the sun and impact Earth's atmosphere. And we're somewhat protected from this phenomenon by the magnetosphere. So it's essentially the magnetic field lines that surround the Earth. But certain events such as solar flares you may have heard of, mm-hmm. or coronal mass ejections can basically impact or compress these magnetic field lines and deposit a large amount of energy specifically into the poles. And so what often happens is these charged particles, this is basically a plasma that's arriving from the sun. So it's things like protons and electrons. So these particles are traveling very fast, and they have an electrical charge. And so charged particles interact with our magnetic field lines from the Earth's magnetic field, and this energy can be deposited into the atmosphere. And a main way that this happens is into the polar regions. And the phenomenon that most people are familiar with, that where we can visibly see this happening quite often, is the aurora, or northern lights. And so basically this region of the atmosphere, because it's a very, very thin kind of upper extension of Earth's atmosphere, there's really not much between it and the sun. So it's kind of our first line of defense here on Earth's surface for protection from things like far ultraviolet photons and cosmic rays and these high-energy plasma particles, which are basically intercepted by the upper atmosphere. And so this is where a lot of interesting chemistry and dynamics occur.
Eric, we're pretty fortunate that we have our magnetic field and we have our atmosphere to absorb and to deflect a lot of this. And my understanding, please correct me if I'm wrong, is that for the most part, solar flares, even in their max, you know, they could disrupt some satellites, and, you know, it's something we have to stay on top of. But the CMEs, the coronal mass injection, specifically the one in 2012. I know NASA originally came out and sort of said, "Hey, listen, these things can't hurt you," but the truth is that they can. Is that correct?
Yeah, that is correct. The 2012 event was, as I understand, and I'm not by no means a solar physicist, but as I understand, that was a near miss, and a big part of this is just kind of, it's a matter of time that a CME, and CMEs happen all the time, and the high-energy particles from them reach Earth quite often, and generally they do follow solar flares. The one in 2012 you mentioned was very, very large, you know, possibly on the order. I think there was a very large event in 1859
yes.
that we have some evidence of, and so it's a bit of speculation, you know, what would have happened, excuse me, had that CME fully impacted Earth. But certainly there is precedent for geomagnetic storm activity and these other events from the sun to impact not just satellites and our orbiting assets, but assets here on Earth.
Yeah, the electrical grid. You know, for an example, that would kind of knock us back into the dark ages for a while. And if they had large transformers that they had to replace, that could take, you know, that could certainly take a bit.
Exactly. And there was a, you know, an example of that. I believe it was in the late 1980s.
Yes.
In Quebec, there was
Canada.
A major power outage that was basically due to an event that was probably smaller than the one from 2 years ago that missed us, luckily.
Yeah, so the one 2 years ago did miss us by about a week, and you know, scientists have quantified the probability of 12% of an event like this occurring in the next, I think, 20 years or something, or during
exactly
the cycle.
Something out to 2025 or
So I'll just ask one last question, because I know we're not here to talk about CMEs, but I am curious. I understand that the large CME from July 23rd, 2012, it took 3 to 5 days to have reached Earth if it was in our direction. Again, it missed us by a week.
Right.
If it takes 3 to 5 days, and we knew that something big was happening, first of all, do we have devices out there that track these sorts of things? And secondarily, if we knew something was coming, if we shut down or did certain things on the planet to get our grid, you know, a little bit more protected, is that possible with that notice of 3 to 5 days?
Yeah, great question. The first part, we do have assets that are looking at the sun and are monitoring sunspots, and which are basically known hotspots of activity in the sun that can be a source of these solar flares and CMEs. So we do have a fairly constant monitor on the surface of the sun and what's going on. So there would be some kind of fair warning. As you mentioned, it takes a few days usually for these particles to reach our atmosphere and to reach Earth because they're traveling very, very fast, but they're still traveling a fraction of the speed of light. Second part of the question, you know, what could we do? I think you nailed it. It's basically shut down major electrical systems. You know, in space, this happens quite often. It's actually fairly routine for satellites that are in certain orbits to go through. For instance, there's a feature called the South Atlantic Anomaly, which is a high radiation environment, and this is where the lower of the two Van Allen radiation belts often drops down to a much lower altitude, down into the type of altitude where low Earth orbiting satellites are traveling through. And so it's very common for instance, Hubble has done this in the past, to shut off operations completely during transit through this high radiation environment. So that's as far as I know, I'm definitely not an expert in this field, but I think that's about what you would have to do with assets on Earth as well, in terms of electrical power systems and stuff like that.
Yeah, I would just throw this out there. They speculated that the July 23rd, 2012, if it had hit us, it could have knocked the entire world's grid off for 4 years. And I want everyone to think about what that might mean if you went without electricity, the chaos that would follow that. I mean, just
being without our iPhones for 4 hours would be a big enough catastrophe, but
let alone 4 years.
Let alone 4 years of power. That's back to the dark ages, as you said.
That's right. So, Eric, I'm wondering, so this magnetic shield, it gets compressed, it allows through the CMEs and the solar flares, or CMIs, and solar flares. Is this the area that your device, and I guess I call it a device, again, it's the Imaging Dispersive Energy Analyzer, or IDEA,
right.
Is this the area that that it will be concentrated in to then learn more about that specific area?
Yeah, so exactly. So what really happens here is we have these three terms, and I've thrown all of them out: magnetosphere, ionosphere, and thermosphere. These are actually overlapping volumes of space, and we've given them different names based on the stuff that they're made out of rather than the altitude, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So in Earth's atmosphere, of course, we have the troposphere, stratosphere, and then the mesosphere, which is kind of the upper part of our atmosphere where it turns in, where we transition into space. But then we have this region where the thermosphere is basically the electrically neutral component of the atmosphere. And this is where the bulk of the mass actually is. But it's harder to study because these particles are basically atoms and molecules, kind of like we have in our atmosphere, but it's a different composition. Whereas the ionosphere is the plasma or electrically charged component of this volume of space. And so it's much easier to study because we have a variety of techniques and instruments, both in situ, so sampling as we fly through, mm-hmm. and also remote sensing instruments, either from space or from the ground. So that's really our interest, is filling this kind of last critical gap in our knowledge of the upper atmosphere, which is on the side of the thermosphere.
Mm.
It is the bulk of the mass, but it is probably less understood than the ionosphere and magnetosphere because it is harder to build instruments that can make these measurements with both high sensitivity and high accuracy. And it's very important because in terms of the energy flow that we've been talking about, there's just this constant coupling and dynamics between all three of these regions, the magnetosphere, ionosphere, and thermosphere. And a lot of this energy ends up being kind of shows up in the form of bulk movement of the thermosphere and the temperature of the thermosphere. So that's exactly what this instrument is designed to measure for us, is the wind, the temperature, even though this is a very, very thin region of the atmosphere. You know, if you think about the total pressure or density, it's at 400 kilometers, it's roughly, you know, one part in 100 billion compared to the density of the atmosphere here on Earth's surface. So that's the first obstacle to overcome, is that there's not a lot of stuff up there. It's just enough stuff that it can cause problems with spacecraft drag. So that's one of the applications we're really interested in studying and helping predict spacecraft drag better. The other issue is when you're trying to measure this neutral wind, to really improve these atmospheric models to predict spacecraft drag, for instance, or these other effects on spacecraft, ideally you want to be able to measure with a precision or resolution of 5 meters per second or less. Now, the tricky part is the satellite you're measuring from is moving at 7,500 meters per second. So this is like sticking your arm out the window of a car that's traveling 100 miles an hour and saying, oh, I think the wind just shifted by 0.1 mile per hour. I could detect that. And so that's essentially what we're trying to do here. That's one of the big technical challenges of designing these types of instruments.
Hmm. So in designing this instrument, did you model other instruments that exist and are able to measure dynamics in other layers of the atmosphere, or how did you go about this?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's actually exactly how we got started in this work. I was collaborating with a couple of my colleagues here at the Space Dynamics Lab, and with colleagues of ours at the NASA Goddard Space Flight Center, as well as the Naval Research Lab. And our colleagues over there in the D.C. area had come up with an instrument they called the Wind and Temperature Spectrometer. And this was to basically measure these exact types of things I'm talking about here. So wind, temperature, density, composition, really focusing on the thermosphere. And so as a result of that collaboration, we actually we had a flight spare of one of their instruments that flew on a small satellite. We did some testing in our laboratory here, which we've designed to allow us to do testing and calibration of these types of instruments. And so we really learned a lot about the sensor technology and what it takes to make neutral wind measurements. And we also learned that there were some problems and some challenges that they were trying to overcome with their instrument. And so I was kind of daydreaming one day and thought, well, I think I have the solution here.
Aha, so, that's how it happens. It's the scientist daydreaming. Okay.
Exactly. I was actually at the SmallSat conference, which we host every year here at USU and SDL, and I was sitting in a talk, and it might not have been as interesting as the previous talk, so I was kind of doodling in my notebook and taking some notes, and I thought, holy cow, I think this is it. You know, this is how we're going to make this measurement. And so I went and basically spent I was awarded some money through Space Dynamics Lab. We have a very strong internal research and development program, or IRAD, and so we put money into new technology concepts and basic research to try to really get out ahead of the curve and develop the next generation of instruments for space science. So I was awarded some money through that program, and basically took on a full campaign of modeling and simulations and analysis and parlayed that into another small grant, which we currently have through NASA right now. And so based on that grant, we are building the hardware and currently have it in our vacuum chamber, which basically simulates the space environment. And we're firing beams of charged particles at it to make sure that it's working like we thought it would.
Eric, there's a tremendous amount of money to be made and a tremendous amount of money to be lost in commercial satellites. And certainly understanding the whole space drag thing, because they want to keep these things in orbit and they want to keep them in the right position. Is there any possibility that your instrument could be deployed in the future on individual satellites that the companies would pay a lot of money for?
Yeah, I think that's a strong possibility. You know, right now we're definitely targeting the government customers, so NASA and DOD primarily. But certainly there's a high potential for these commercial satellite providers to show an interest in kind of taking that problem on themselves. So this is exactly one way you could do that. So if they had an in-situ sensor on board where they could measure the variations through an orbit in real time.
They can make adjustments.
In terms of the total density and winds, exactly. They can make adjustments. And obviously most of the spacecraft do have thrusters on board, have propulsion for attitude control and for maintenance of a certain orbit. And so they are able to make very fine adjustments. But what's missing really is the data and the information. And if there's a large geomagnetic storm, for instance, it's not unusual to have the density change very quickly by a factor of 10 or more. And that can have very, very large implications for just tracking satellites from the ground. And you can essentially lose track of them and spend the rest of the day or the rest of the week trying to lock on again. Meanwhile, there's some other problem occurring and your assets are taken by this spacecraft drag issue.
Oh, fortunately, we have Sandra Bullock and George Clooney we can deploy if we need them.
Yeah, exactly.
But as the atmosphere heats up, it expands. And when it expands, that has something to do with producing additional drag on satellites.
Exactly, yep.
Okay.
And the hard part here is that when you look at the atmospheric models, one of these is called MSIS. It's been around for quite a while. It was first developed at the Naval Research Lab. This is a purely empirical model, which means it's based on measurements. But a lot of these measurements are going back to a series of satellites known as Atmosphere Explorer and Dynamics Explorer, which started in the 60s and continued through the 80s and maybe into the early 90s. But a lot of this mass spectrometer data, where we're getting this neutral data or net neutral density and composition data from, is really quite old. So what's needed ultimately is just new observations and hopefully persistent observations, meaning we have at least one of these up at all times collecting this data.
So you've had other in situ instruments attached to satellites in the ionosphere and the magnetosphere? Did I get that right?
Yep.
Yeah.
There you go.
So you've had the how long have those existed?
Oh gosh. Well, you're talking about the about instruments in general, not just instruments that we've deployed here at the Space Lab, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
So these instruments have existed for almost as long as the space program, actually.
Okay. So you've been able to monitor lots of things up in those strata of the atmosphere for a while.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
And some of these were very, very, some of these original instruments were extremely simple and crude, but we have, again, a lot of the data a lot of the models we're currently using is still using that data. So, for instance, you're probably familiar with accelerometers,
mm-hmm.
which is basically a device to measure change in acceleration in some direction. And so most satellites are outfitted with accelerometers, and some of the earliest neutral density data basically relied on the fact that if you have, as you mentioned, thermal expansion or expansion of the atmosphere, and then density goes up and the spacecraft drag goes up, what happens is the spacecraft slows down a little bit. It decelerates. And so if you have a sensitive accelerometer on board, you can actually convert that data into a total neutral density at the exact spot that the satellite is flying through.
Sorry to cut you off. We're just about out of time, but before we let you go, I just have to have you explain. We're constantly amazed by what's going on at Utah State in the Space Dynamics Lab and in other areas of the university, all kinds of interesting research and science going on. But talk a little bit about the Space Dynamics Lab. It's not at Utah State University. It's just one of the universities that has a lab. Is that right? They're located throughout the country?
Right, exactly. So we are owned by Utah State University, but we're on what's called the Innovation Campus, about a mile north of Utah State University. We are classified as a not-for-profit research organization. And we started as a university lab on campus, and some years ago we basically outgrew our facilities, and so now we're still very, very closely tied in and affiliated with USU, but we operate under the Utah State University Research Foundation, and so we're basically a business unit of that research foundation, and so we do a variety of work. This is the stuff we're talking about today is a kind of a small chunk of what we do. We work mainly for the government customers, so DOD, NASA, NOAA. We currently have 450 employees, about 150 students who are working on real projects, and a lot of these projects are to deliver flight hardware for space missions. So it's just a tremendous opportunity for educating students at USU, mostly in engineering departments, but I currently mentor students in physics as well, both undergrad and graduate. So we have a long history of deploying instruments in space on the NASA side. That's my particular interest. We basically serve all four of the science divisions of NASA. So we've done missions for astrophysics, earth science, heliophysics, and we're now getting into planetary science, which is really fun.
Yeah,
sending things to asteroids and stuff like that.
Wow, that is so cool. Okay, so I incorrectly understood then that this Space Dynamics Lab is one of nine or so that is a collective throughout the country. I mean, Utah State, this is just particular to Utah State University, but you may collaborate with others.
We are a Utah State lab. What you might have read is that we do have employees at various locations spread around the country. Most everybody is located right here in North Logan.
Okay. And the Innovation Campus, is that also where the EV charging track is going to be constructed?
I am not familiar with that.
Okay. All right. That must be another cool department at that university.
I think that
maybe that could be next week's interview.
I think that was a separate location.
Yeah. Yeah, well, we already did the interview on that. I just forget where it was located.
Okay.
It's like a quarter-mile track that's going to be one charging strip to charge electric vehicles.
Oh, so, I got you. Right.
Yeah. So another dynamic lab there at Utah State University. Well, very interesting. Dr. Eric Sierstad, I hope I pronounced that somewhat correctly.
That's perfect.
Great.
Good, yep.
And congratulations again on your patent, and best of luck to you, and we'll be interested in hearing more about you in the news.
Thank you so much. It was great to be on with you guys.
All right. Take care.
Thanks, Eric.
Okay.
And again, Dr. Eric Sierstad of Utah State University with his new patent issued for his new space weather sensor, the IDEA, Imaging Dispersive Energy Analyzer. I like that he has a simple acronym.
Yeah, we just like acronyms, period.
Gotta love those acronyms. Well, stay tuned. We'll be back in just a moment. We're going to speak with Dr. David Belknap of the University of Utah. He specializes in imaging viruses with his electron microscope. Very interesting. We'll be right back. This is Cool Science Radio, only in Park City, only on KPCW. Stay with us.
The Spur Bar and Grill is proud to support KPCW. Located down the alley at 352 Main Street, The Spur features live music, cocktails, and Southern pub grub. Open daily at 5 p.m. Our website, thespurbarandgrill.com, includes music schedules, menus, and contact information.
Nexus IT is proud to have supported KPCW for the past 10 years. Nexus IT provides on-premise and cloud voice over IP, phone systems, and service that simplify and unify your business telecommunications. 435-487-9099, nexusitc.net.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells here with my co-host, Lynn Ware Peake. We just spoke with Dr. Eric Sierstad of Utah State University about his invention, the Imaging Dispersive Energy Analyzer, he just received a patent on. And now we're joined by another scientist who, instead of studying plasma and gas in space, he studies something right here on Earth. And in the wake of the Ebola outbreak in Africa, news literally every day about that, we thought we'd invite someone on the show who specializes in viruses. Dr. David Belknap from the University of Utah studies viruses at the electron microscopy. Oh, boy. I'm going to
How about microscopy? There we
microscopy go. Microscopy core laboratory. And he does everything with viruses, from looking at the structure, the function, assembly, assembly and the disassembly of viruses. He is the director of the electron
How about let's call it the EM?
Let's call it the EM core lab at the U. And he's joining us by phone, Dr. David Belknap. Welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you very much. Pleased to be with you.
You want to pronounce that word for both of us?
Electron microscopy.
Oh, microscopy. All right. Okay. Well, we hope you got a good chuckle from the way we were pronouncing it.
Yeah, it's great.
Dr. Belknap, in preparing for the show, for our conversation this morning, I took a peek at a bunch of pictures of viruses. And I got to tell you, the scariest monsters Hollywood can possibly come up with don't hold a candle to these real monsters, or what appear to be monsters when you blow them up.
They some very, very interesting shapes that we can see. And one of the interesting things about them is that They come in a vast variety of shapes, from more spherical type of shapes that are very rigid, and we have these kind of lunar module type of shapes. We also have long rods. We have blobs, kind of you could think of putting something in a balloon, a very flexible, like a water balloon. Like, yeah. you're going to throw a water balloon at your friend, you know, that kind of shape that doesn't hold shape very well. One of my favorites is one that actually looks like a bottle, like a soda bottle or something like that. That's one of my favorites. And then there's lemon-shaped ones. Anyway, there's quite a variety of shapes.
So those are the viruses, and I couldn't help myself. I found this site called Six Microscopic Images That Will Blow Your Mind, and they had like a bed bug in there, and the slug and a flea, and oh boy, these things are just, they could not be scarier or uglier. But I wanted to ask you, the electron microscope was first built in 1930 or something, 31, and they've long been used to describe viruses. Yet few people know a lot about the device. Can you tell us what an electron microscope is, how they work in sort of layperson's terms, and what they're used for?
Sure. So, yeah, what we want to do, the purpose of them is to look at small things, things that are not visible with light. So they're actually smaller than can be seen with visible light, with a visible light microscope that most of us have used in high school or so, high school classes and so forth. The way that an electron microscope works is there's usually an electron source, so you have to make electron beams. So your previous guest was talking about these charged particles that fly through space. Well, we have to make them and make them here on Earth, and the way we do that is you have a filament, and it's like the old incandescent light bulbs, where you know remember how it heats up and glows, and that's similar to the way electron microscope filament will be, and what you can do then is if you then put an electric field near that, you can actually pull the electrons in a direction and actually form a beam. And then what we also have are lenses that are made of, that are essentially just electromagnets. So again, going back to our fun days of science classes or just hobbies in the house, you wind some wire around in a coil, you can make it a magnet with that. Like you wind it around a nail or something, that will form an electromagnet. And that's how our lenses are made in the electron microscope. It's just simply windings of wire. And so those are used to first focus the beam onto a specimen, and then after that, used to actually image, form an image and magnify that image.
It's interesting how you study viruses, and that's what you specialize in, and yet you can, you know, I drive a car, but I couldn't tell you how the thing is put together. You know, you study viruses, but you can very well explain how electron microscope is put together and constructed. Is this something that, how long has an electron microscope been around, and where are they manufactured?
So, yes, they've been around since, as John said, they were invented in the 1930s. And incidentally, it's kind of interesting that it was shortly after it was told to be theoretically possible to use electrons to make an image. And so, so they've been around since then, and I forgot the rest of your question.
Yeah, just wonder. I'm just kind of fascinated by how much you know about the electron microscope. I guess you have to. In your studies, do you service the microscopes? Do you just order them from a central manufacturer?
Yes. You were wondering where they're made.
Yeah.
Right now, the ones that we use are made by three companies. There's two companies in Japan, Hitachi and JEOL. Make microscopes, and also a company called FEI, which is based in Oregon, just outside of Portland. But the plant where they're made is actually in Holland, and it was owned previously by Philips Corporation.
Huh. Okay. Interesting.
Yeah, and so it helps to understand your instrument as best you can, and I do service it some, but we also pay for other people to come from the company to come and take care of problems that we can't handle locally.
Right. So you're the director of the Electron Microscopy Core Laboratory at the University of Utah. And, how many scientists are in there, and are you a lab that also has graduate students or even undergraduates working with you?
Yes. So we work with a variety of people from undergraduates through professors, postdoctoral fellows, graduate students, to help them with their research. So we look at all kinds of things. I think at last count it was over 100 different laboratories we've worked with here at the U and elsewhere to help them with their projects, from imaging particles that material scientists are putting together to biological particles, to imaging tissue samples. We also do some clinical services here where we actually image tissues from patients, patient biopsies, particularly kidney diseases are particularly amenable to being diagnosed through a microscope. So we do quite a variety of things here.
Oh, interesting. So I just have to tell you that you can't see us in the studio here, but John's trying to distract me by showing me on his iPad pictures of a bed bug, images of a bed bug. And I'm telling you, this is something that you must find very interesting in your study, is the images that you're able to see of even a virus. And it just makes me wonder, my next question would be, what hooked you about viruses, looking at them?
Yeah, that's a fun question. So when I was in graduate school, I had been intended to work on cellular particles. So they're interesting looking cellular particles also that help us maintain life. But my professor just said, "Hey, would you help us by by doing this virus project. And I said, sure, and that ended up to be my thesis. And then the same thing happened when I went to do postdoctoral work later at the National Institutes of Health. The same thing happened. So I just say that I've been infected. And I just find them very interesting, and there's a lot we can learn about them and a lot we can learn about life. I think one of the things that had first turned me off about viruses is that the idea that they just cause disease. But the more we learn about viruses, the more we are coming to understand, and we don't have a complete understanding yet, but it just seems that they're a very essential part of life on Earth. They aren't just there to cause disease, but have been instrumental in helping its evolution as well. There are some important factors that they do that we're just coming to understand now.
And Dr. Belknap, one of the electron microscope images that I looked at was of the 1918 Spanish flu virus that killed more than 500,000 people in the United States and up to 50 million worldwide. And I am curious, we've stated a couple times now that it was first developed in the 30s, and of course the Spanish flu was in the 1918s. If we had electron microscopes back then, could we have tackled this thing more effectively?
I don't know. I would say probably not. They are valuable tools for us now. But a lot of what has to be done, the electron microscopes helps us see the structure of them, how they're composed. But a lot of what has to be done to help fight a disease is other types of experiments. So the electron microscopy, while it's very interesting and helpful, is really a complement to other techniques. So,
okay. Looking at these images, you can see the lines of defense that these viruses have set up for themselves. They're stagnant. They're static pictures. They're not moving. I'm curious. How do these viruses evolve, and how do they morph so easily?
Viruses. One of the reasons that they do change so fast is that there's so many of them. So when you have an infection, you can have thousands, hundreds usually or so per cell. I'm not exactly sure how many each cell produces in an influenza infection, but usually many are made, and each one can be slightly different. And so each one with a slightly different characteristic, then that can go off, and if that has an advantage to infecting another cell, then that's how they can evolve, and evolve rather quickly because there's so many of them, and usually the reproductive process involves mutations, and so that just makes it very easy to mutate and make new ones that can have different characteristics.
You know, David, we go to the doctor, and the doctor tells us whether or not we have a bacterial or a viral infection. Bacterial infections we can treat. Viral infections, you just have to, you know, let it run its course, essentially, right?
Right.
And so, what is the difference there? I mean, we've heard this our whole lives from doctors, but we don't really know what it means. What light could you shed on that question?
So, yeah, that's a very good question. So, bacteria often have some very unusual characteristic that can be exploited. They might use a different process than our human cells do in either reproducing or synthesizing their outer shell. They often have an outer shell layer of carbohydrates or something, and so that can often be used and exploit it and say, okay, we can target this. But one of the things about viruses that makes them so difficult to treat is that viruses infect our own cells. And yes, we could get rid of the viruses, but we'll also get rid of our own cells and we'll kill our own cells because the viruses exploit normal processes in order to reproduce. So it's like cancer. You know, cancer is similar, whereas cancer, yeah, we could kill cancer, but you kill the patient as well.
Right.
You could kill it easily, but you'd kill the patient as well.
What is the main value that the electron microscope image provides to the medical community?
I think understanding how viruses are put together and helping us understand maybe possible ways that things of things that could be exploited for treatment. For example, if you understand that a virus is put together in a certain way or changes in a certain way as it's infecting a cell, you could inhibit that process. And the electron microscope allows us to see what is actually changing, and so we could design a target drug or something for that particular process.
And when you view a virus, is the virus already dead? Does the microscope, you know, bang on the virus pretty hard so you can't see it dynamically moving around?
Yes and no. Often what we do is we actually dry them out and put some metal stain on it, and that usually essentially kills them. But also we can look at them frozen, so we can freeze them and look at them, and that may actually let them survive.
Is there technology out now or coming soon that will allow you to look at these viruses dynamically interacting in a body?
Yes, there is actually. Normally in an electron microscope, the sample has to be a solid. What I didn't mention earlier is that inside the microscope is a vacuum, and so you can't have liquid in there or it'll evaporate away. And so normally samples have to be completely solid. But there is a device now that has a small little device that will allow you to put a liquid sample inside of it and then insulate it. It insulates it from the vacuum of the microscope.
So you're looking at a virus and you're looking for qualities that can either be exploited, as you say, to come up with some treatment. But say you're looking at the Ebola virus, obviously it's very elusive and they haven't figured out. I mean, if you were looking at that Ebola virus, and I don't know if you've had a chance to at all, but you know, what are you seeing that's different, and why is it, if it is so different, why is that scary?
So Ebola, I haven't looked at it in the microscope myself. It's a class 4 pathogen, which means you have to look at it in special labs. But I have looked at other people's images of it, and what you can learn from that is, again, there have been people who have looked at it, and what they're trying to understand is how is it put together. So in this case, Ebola has a what's called a nucleocapsid. So a virus, if we go back to what a virus is really a package of a gene, and it's holding this gene. And so the gene has to be delivered to a particular place in the cell so it can be reproduce.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you can understand is, by looking at Ebola, for example, you can see that it has what's called a nucleocapsid, and that's proteins that directly surround the gene. And then outside of that is a membrane that packages it. So it's like a balloon. It's like it's in a balloon. And it's kind of like one of those long balloons that you get at the circus that people that tie up into different shapes. It's kind of like that. On the outside is one of those long balloons with this protein genetic material all wrapped up together. And so you could view how that's put together, and maybe you can look at it closely and come up with some ideas of how to disrupt a process. Or one of the ways that we've actually noticed with polio and other viruses like common cold viruses is that you can maybe inhibit it by just keeping it together, tightly together, and not allowing it to come undone. So things like that could also be done.
So are they then making any headway with the Ebola virus?
Well, I think so. It sounded like the doctor and the missionary who were in West Africa and flown to the U.S. were given some special treatment that I'm not sure what that is, but it sounded like that was really helping them. So I think, yes, they have made headway. I'm not sure how much the electron microscope helped on that, but it does sound like they were making some headway.
Okay. We're just about out of time here, but really quickly, what's your favorite virus and why?
My favorite virus?
Or, you know, the one that fascinates you the most.
Well, sounds like Oprah. If you were a virus, what would you be?
Yeah.
What would I be? Oh.
Don't start crying now.
Yeah, okay. I've spent most of my career studying what's called icosahedral viruses. These are viruses that have, the icosahedron is a 20-sided sphere, basically, with made up of 20 equal lateral triangles. And this can be formed into bigger and smaller units in various ways. And I've really enjoyed looking at them and the symmetry that they have. And actually, they can be kind of beautiful. That's been my favorite, probably my favorite, if I had to pick one right now.
I can see why. Thanks for picking that one. That's pretty cool.
David, thank you for being on our program this morning. Really, really enjoyed the conversation.
Oh, you're very welcome. Happy to be here.
Yeah, Dr. David Belknap from the University of Utah, who runs the Electron Microscope Lab. We are going to take a short break, and when we return, today's cool story, the mystery.
This is Michelle from Peak Art and Frame, proud supporters of KPCW. Locally owned and operated, Peak Art and Frame features local photography and artwork, as well as digital printing, custom framing, and mirrors. Open 7 days a week, rush service available, located in the Walmart Shopping Center, 649-0801, peakartandframe.com.
Support for KPCW comes from the Park City Mountain Resort, committed to keeping the resort open this 2014-15 season for the community and for guests. More at keepparkcityopen.com.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware, Peak, here with John Wells. Want to thank our guests today, Dr. Eric Sierstad and Dr. David Belknap. And, you know, I've heard in the last 24 hours this fascinating story that really shouldn't be so fascinating, because imagine the study of watching 500-pound boulders move and trying to figure it out in Death Valley.
Well, it's been a mystery for a long time. Lots of different theories.
Yeah, lots of different theories about how these lines that look like kind of smear lines, as though a big boulder has come in and smeared along the surface of this dry playa, it's called, out in Death Valley. They've had theories. People have done doctoral theses on it, thinking maybe it's wind or maybe it's the slippery dynamic of the mud when it gets wet. They even have thought about maybe it's thick ice sheets. Well, they've solved the mystery, and in part due to the fact that they came. I love this part. This is like, you know, a faux rock. No, I think they'd take a real rock, they bore a little hole into it, put a GPS in it so they can track if that rock moves.
They can find out when it does move and come out and see what's going on.
Exactly. And so literally these scientists sat over, you know, like on a hillside above the playa, and watched rocks move. Does that sound exciting?
It doesn't. And I'm curious, how far would a 500-pound boulder actually move?
Well, I'm not certain about the 500-pound boulders, but some big boulders moved up to 700 feet. And so this was after a very particular climactic event that was a rain, and then it was cold, and it was a thin layer of ice frozen on top of this little lake that was created. And when it started to melt, it was crucial that it melted in the middle of the lake. And it wasn't a lake. It's just a huge puddle on this very flat surface. And then there were these thin layers of ice that would then push up against a rock and kind of batter it, bug it until it would move. Isn't that bizarre? I just think it's wild.
I wish our listeners could see your arm and hand movements as you're describing this rock moving. It's pretty cool, actually.
Well, I know. I think it's fascinating. And so they discovered it wasn't big, thick sheets of ice. It was thin ice and the perfect amount of water dislodging those boulders. So voila.
Mystery of how rocks move across Death Valley, not Deer Valley, and solved by Lynn Ware Peak.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by
Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-LAW.com.
We want to thank our underwriters, San Francisco Design, Berkshire Hathaway Home Service, Utah Properties, Peak Art and Frame, and Nexus IT.
It's KPCW Park City.